Welcome into White Sox Weekly. We're on a winning streak. How about that? A couple in a row for the White Sox after what I believe was the team's best played game all season on Thursday afternoon to salvage a series against the Brewers. And then last night here at Raitt Field, another good win for the White Sox as they beat the Astros, who they welcomed to town for a three-game series this weekend. They took the opener of that series 7-3 last night. It has been the last couple nights just remind you, if you're a baseball fan, why you can fall in love with your team, and the day in and day out of baseball is unmatched by any other sport, because you can just get yourself a two-game win streak and all of a sudden just upbeat. It's more fun to come to the ballpark, and today looks like a beautiful day to come to the ballpark. Hanging out here right now inside the broadcast booth looking over at Raitt Field, and it is sun splashed. It is beautiful. The grounds crew is working, getting the field ready for today's action, and it's not too hot. It's that crisp, you know, mid-50s, potentially lower 60s day here today at Raitt Field. So if you're looking for something to do on a Saturday afternoon with a very good team in town with the Astros, come on by and see if the White Sox can extend it to 3 today here at Raitt Field. I am Jeff Meller, and if you're unfamiliar with White Sox Weekly, we're on every Saturday 2 hours prior to our pregame coverage, which will start at 12:30 today. And of course, we'll have first pitch at 1:10 for game number 2 of the White Sox and Astros. On White Sox Weekly today, a quick rundown. We're going to give you a quick synopsis of what you may have missed the last couple days. Also expecting to hear from Jonathan Cannon, who was a really, really nice effort last night. He's now put together 2 really good ones in a row. Expecting to hear from him around 11:30. Also, might touch base with James Fegan, who covers the White Sox for Sox Machine. Depending on the timing, we'll see if that works out. So, and also have plenty of pretty cool features. If you may have missed them during the week, John Garland hopped in the booth with Len Casper and Darren Jackson during a game earlier this week, and then also Aaron Rowan did so last night. So we're going to let you hear them in the booth with Len and DJ. So lots of good stuff. Oh, and the White Sox named their minor league hitter and pitchers of the month. We'll let you hear from them as well in our minor league report. So let's get after it. We're going to start with the last couple days. As I mentioned, it is warming up a bit, and normally when that happens, Luis Robert gets going, and that certainly has been the case. And in retrospect, Chris Getz met the media on Tuesday at the start of this homestand, and this soundbite could not have been more prescient when it comes to Luis Robert.
For us going into the season, it was really navigating April, keeping him on the field, knowing that as the weather warmed up, there was going to be more production in there, and I think it's safe to assume that that's likely to happen. You know, I know he gets frustrated at times, and we do as well, wanting him to come through in big moments. But he has come through plenty of moments this year for us. So we still have faith in Louis, and we know that Louis is doing everything he can to be more productive. But, you know, we feel like it's about to turn, and hopefully here it warms up, and we can continue to see more positives from Louis.
And sure enough, over the last week, as it has warmed up just a bit, Luis Robert, over the last 7 days, is 8-for-22. He's hit 3 home runs, driven in 8. He's got 5 walks over that period of time and 6 stolen bases with an on-base percentage of .481. And oh, by the way, that's just the bat. Let's start things out with the way things started out on Thursday afternoon with Sean Burke on the mound. Burke had loaded the bases via the walk, but with a couple of outs, Luis Robert saved the day.
Swinging a high fly ball, center field, it's deep. Robert's still back. He is at the fence, and he makes a catch. A leaping grab right at the wall. I don't know if it would have been a home run.
Oh, it would have been. He got that one and brought it back.
What a catch by Luis Robert Jr. Yep, you're right. He reached over that yellow line. That would have been a grand slam. As it is, they don't score. We head to the bottom of the first. Nothing, nothing.
That was huge. That really did set the tone for Thursday's game. Sean Burke, even after the game, tweeted, "Thank you, Panther." He said, "I owe him something. Not sure what it is because he makes a lot more money than me." But, of course, and Sean Burke settled down after that too, which was nice. But in the bottom half of the same inning, Luis Robert came through at the plate.
The pitch, Swing and a base hit on the ground through the drawn-in infield and into left. And it's 1-0.
Well, we noticed that he was doing a really good job keeping his hands in a good position to attack, and they tried to sneak the fastball on him. He was too quick. He got to the two-seamer and hard through the drawn-in infield.
So it's 1-0.
And after that, Luis Robert actually stole a base as well. He is now, he still leads the American League in stolen bases, but after a couple from O'Neill Cruz last night, O'Neill Cruz took over the Major League lead with 14, but Luis Robert is in second with 13, and he does lead the American League. Sean Burke, as I mentioned, settled down after that huge rob of the Grand Slam by Robert, and this is what that sounded like.
2-2 from Burke. Foul tip, strike three. There's his 1-2-3. Foul tip, strike three. Third strikeout for Burke. The 3-2 home swung on and missed strike three. Back-to-back Ks for Burke. He has retired seven straight. 3-2 pitch, swing and a miss, strike three. Sean Burke mowing him down.
So that was absolutely a huge, huge save by Robert, and that allowed Sean Burke to settle down and get back to pitching the way we know that he's capable of. We saw him dominate last September when he made his Major League debut, and then on Thursday he goes six scoreless innings, strikes out five, lowered his ERA to 4.91, and it's that performance, it's the performance he gave on opening day, and the what he was able to do at the end of September last season as to why I think a lot of folks around here are excited about what Sean Burke could be for this rotation in the future. Now, how about, it's not just Robert who's heating up as the weather warms up, but Miguel Vargas has made an adjustment with his hands, and it is certainly paying dividends as he extended his hitting streak to a career-high 8 games on Thursday afternoon.
1-2. Hit high in the air out into deep left. Way back there. It is gone. Vargas with a three-run homer. It was on a changeup. And it's 4-0.
Well, it looked like he was committed. He did such a great job making sure to keep his nose down on that baseball and not pull off of it.
His second of the year.
Will Venable actually talked about Miguel Vargas' recent success in the pregame that day.
Miguel, you know, he's been consistent with his plate discipline, and we know that that's been part of his skill set, you know, from the beginning, at least, you know, starting in spring training with me. But, yeah, he's started to figure out how to make impact and move the ball forward. And, you know, now those good at-bats are ending in, you know, base hits and extra bases and some runs for us. So, yeah, this is just part of his development. And, you know, I think the good thing is that, you know, his skill set, you know, with the plate discipline, you know, feel confident that that's going to be there, you know. And so now that he's been able to put, move some balls forward, it's also exciting.
You love that. Now, Vargas's hit streak was snapped last night, but nevertheless, he certainly made the adjustment in season, which can be hard to do at times, and it is certainly paying dividends early on. One more highlight from Thursday. Luis Roberts came to the plate with the bases loaded, and he did not fail.
2-1 is lined out into deep right center, and it's over the head of Cheerio. Taylor scores. Meidroth right behind him. He will score. Benintendi is in. It is a bases clearing double for Robert. 8-0.
And that is exactly how the game ended. White Sox shut out the Brewers as they head out of town. And then, of course, yesterday evening, the White Sox built on that with their performance against the Astros. Edgar Caro started things off early in the bottom of the first inning for the Sox.
Not running, and the pitch is hammered on a line out in the deep left. And it's over Altuve's head. Meidroth will score. Robert around third. Going to be a play at the plate. Relay throw by Pena is in time. Great tag by Diaz. Robert tried to get his hand in there. And no challenge coming. So that'll go 7-6-2 to get Robert. It is 1-0.
The one thing I'll point out is you love the aggression there. The send by Justin Jersey, the Astros had to put together an absolutely perfect throw from Jose Altuve in left field, who, by the way, if you haven't been watching, even though he's made the transition to left field from second base, he certainly has not covered himself in glory at that position defensively. Testing him and then having, Jeremy Peña have to make a perfect relay throw to the plate. It's a situation where you completely understand why Justin Jersley sent him in that moment. And each and every day with your best base runner rounding third, made all the sense in the world. Make the Astros be perfect on that play. They were. And actually, I think I said Peña. I believe it was Rogers, actually, in retrospect, who made the relay throw. But nevertheless, force the Astros to be perfect early in the game. You hate to make the out at home plate, but at the same time, completely understand and like the aggression on the base pass there. And it was also a great slide by Luis Robert. I mentioned you need Altuve to come up with a play in his new position. You need Rogers to make a nice throw. And then Yiner Diaz had to make a really good tag at home plate. So it was a perfect execution by the Astros that prevented Robert from scoring. So I am not critical at all of that send by Jersley and the aggression by the White Sox on the base paths. In fact, I'll actually applaud it. Meanwhile, Chase Meidroth also returned to the lineup this week. That's been a bright spot, and he continued that source of brightness yesterday.
Swinging a ground ball into left, a base hit. Dahlbeck rounding third. The throw by Altuve is going to be late. Chase Meidroth with an RBI hit. It's 2-0.
He's brought a really nice dynamic to the lineup. Of course, Meidroth's ability to get on base, I think, feel pretty comfortable saying, is unmatched up and down this White Sox lineup. Now, I should, before I get ahead of myself, it is, still a small sample size for Chase Meidroth, so he does need to do it over the long haul. But it's exactly what he did in the minors, seeing a lot of pitches, drawing walks, and just being selective as a hitter, and you like to see that because that's something that the White Sox lineup at times has lacked. So Meidroth has brought that to the table. It's funny because Will Venable actually talked about Meidroth's approach in the pregame earlier this week.
Well, yeah, I was super excited about the 3-1 double there. We were even joking beforehand, what are the chances that he swings at this ball? And then he smokes it in the gap, so I was super excited about that. That's what we expect from him. He's going to learn how to make an impact in this league, at the plate. And, it's obviously, again, a guy with really good plate discipline, and he's going to start moving some balls forward with authority. It's going to be fun to watch.
And maybe just I should back up. That was Venable talking about Meidroth hitting a 3-1 double the other day against the Brewers, and how the question on the bench, they were joking around, hey, is he actually going to swing here, having the 3-1 count in his favor? And sure enough, he delivered a double, because that's something that the White Sox did challenge Meidroth on when they sent him down to AAA to begin the season, was, hey, we know you can draw a walk, we know you can see a lot of pitches, but you also need to do some damage when you're in a advantageous count. And seeing a little more of that come in, come to fruition at the major league level is, I think, something that you can be very excited about if you're a Sox fan out there. Also, moving back to yesterday now, I mentioned Luis Robert had a fantastic game on Thursday, and that carried over last night.
There's a swing and a drive. Robert, deep right center. It's gone. And it's 3-1. That's his fifth of the year and his 500th major league hit.
I would say that's exactly how you would draw it up if you were Luis Robert for your 500th hit. You do it in style with a home run. And as I mentioned, he really does look like he's locked in at the plate. And not just locked in, but I'm very fascinated to see the development of Luis Robert, the more selective hitter, because the one thing, even though he was struggling throughout the month of April, and how much of that is related to the cold weather and how much of it is related to him just, getting his timing down as the season begins, I don't know, but he was drawing a lot of walks throughout April. And now to see the weather warm up and to see him still drawing walks, but now hopefully doing damage as well. If he adds that plate discipline, there's no doubt he's got the talent to be a top 10 player in this league. And if he's getting on base with the not once the hits start coming around, all of a sudden Luis Robert is somebody who is just he'll be one of the best players in baseball. He already has the talent to be that, but if you add that plate discipline, that really is the only thing missing from Luis Robert's game. So fun to watch that. One more highlight from last night. We started things off in yesterday's game with a Edgar Caro RBI. Let's close it out with an Edgar Caro RBI.
A swing and a ground ball towards center, base hit. Perfectly placed. Vargas will score. White Sox take advantage of the wild pitch. Caro with his second RBI of the night. And it's 4-1.
So it was a great way to wrap up the evening yesterday as the White Sox win their second in a row. Good times all around. It was a very, very fun evening, and hopefully the White Sox can continue to build on that winning streak, maybe make it 3 in a row. Although I will note they have their work cut out for them today because Hunter Brown is on the mound for the Astros, and last night in the pregame, I was calling Framber Valdez the Astros ace, and perhaps it's one of those things where every team has an ace, right? And Valdez had passed Justin Verlander in terms of like the ace-like status a couple years ago, so my mind had defaulted to, okay, coming into the season, Framber Valdez is the ace. However, Hunter Brown, who's on the mound for the Astros today, is, I think we can, if you go over just the last calendar year, he is undoubtedly the Astros ace. So the White Sox are going to be up against it today. Should be a really good game, though, for the 1:10 first pitch here at Rate Field. Some good pitching if you want to come out and watch at the ballpark today. Hunter Brown up against Davis Martin for the White Sox. All right, just got confirmation. Jeff Blum, who's in the house, he is the TV analyst for the Houston Astros. And White Sox fans, of course, remember Jeff Blum from his fantastic 2005 World Series home run in the 14th inning of Game 3. What an epic classic game. Blummer is in the house. He's going to hop on with us at 11 o'clock. We'll reminisce about the 2005 World Series and pick his brain a little bit about the Houston Astros who are in town. So plenty to do right here on White Sox Weekly. I'm Jeff Meller. This is the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. Jeff Meller back here on White Sox Weekly, and do I have a treat for you. All right, so Jeff Blum's going to hop on at 11 o'clock, 2005 World Series champion. And speaking of that, 2005 World Series champion John Garland joined Len Casper and Darren Jackson in the booth earlier this week.
John, welcome back, and you're all bundled up. You know the deal, man. Before May 1st, you never know.
It's going to be a little chilly. You never know. You're right. You got to stay warm.
So I know you and DJ had an event before the game tonight, and you reminisced a little bit. I'll ask you about something that maybe didn't come up, because I was on the other side of town at that time. You were the guy who got away. Now, if anyone out there doesn't know what I'm talking about, John certainly does. Whenever the Cubs and White Sox make a trade, it is analyzed for decades, and I would say the White Sox got the better of that deal. How did you feel when you got traded? Because you had just... I mean, you had been in the Cubs system, what, like not even a year?
Not even a year. Just barely a year, exactly. It was a shock to the system because I was so young. It showed me the business side of it at a young age. So any time I got traded after that, it wasn't such a shock to the system. And I just kept moving on, you know what I mean? I wanted to play baseball. It didn't matter who. I wanted to go out. I wanted to be on the field and try and prove myself, and it worked out.
Sure did. How many big league games have you attended since you retired?
A handful. Okay. I still go to games in L.A. I'm there in Southern California, so I still go to Dodger games when I can.
How do you watch games as a former pitcher?
I just answered this the other day. I get caught up watching hitters and trying to figure out what I would do.
Love it.
Where if there's a hole, and a lot of times I'm talking through an at-bat and someone sitting next to me is like, what are you doing right now? Like, I apologize. This is kind of the only way I can watch it.
Well, DJ does that as a hitter. I mean, he's already done it a couple times tonight.
Yeah, I'll sit up here and I'll go through sequences as if, you know, this is the way the hitter should be thinking, because you can see. And then you and I were talking about this earlier. there's a tell. The batter was telling the pitcher and catcher what he was trying to do. And then they try to counteract that and go the opposite direction.
Exactly. That's exactly what you're trying to do. You know what the hitter's trying to do. Let's see if we can combat that.
You threw out a ceremonial first pitch tonight. And
we'll loosely say I threw out a
first pitch. Yeah, you lobbed it. Yeah, slider is outside. But what was really cool is instead of wearing your jersey, you wore number 22 with Farmer on the back. And what a nice gesture. Not a day goes by in this booth and Farmio's name doesn't come up. I mean, I keep prodding DJ to write the book. He hasn't written it yet, but he's got enough stories to fill up a book.
I would love to be a part of that book, and I'd love to read that book.
Well, John had a special relationship with Ed as well. I mean, more special than most players.
As we chat with John Garland, DJ, I'm going to let you have Adam here, but I have one last big picture question about 05. I asked Alan Trammell about the 84 Tigers. They started the year 35-5. I said, you got swept in Seattle. You were 35-8. Was there ever any doubt, like, oh, maybe we're not as good as we thought? And he smiled. He said, no, I knew we were better than everybody. Did you have that vibe in 05? Was there ever for you any real doubt? Obviously, the postseason, you steamrolled everybody, but was there a feeling inside that it was your year all year or not?
You could definitely feel there was something. You could definitely feel there was something. I never looked at it like, oh, we're better than everybody else, or you start doing that, you're going to get caught pretty quick. But there was never a time I was ever worried. Like in baseball, you know you're going to go through some winning streaks, you're going to go through some losing streaks. It's too long of a season not to. And you know those are going to come. But it never really was a thought like, oh, we're in trouble. Or we had such a good group of guys, and the biggest thing is we stayed healthy. And when you stay healthy, that's half the battle.
You're in town for this 2005 celebration, and you're coming back for the big weekend right before the All-Star break. How many visits are you going to make this year so the fans can be aware?
There's probably going to be another three.
Okay.
I would assume. I'll be back in June a couple times. We'll see if we can't get to the stadium, do some things.
Well, all right, so we'll resume this conversation.
We don't like the 1-2-3s.
Not when we're
especially,
up.
Especially on our end.
Well, I called a lot of your games, and they were always sellouts either here or at the other place, and you were really a pleasure to watch. And I know how DJ and certainly Farmio felt about you, but great to have you back here.
I greatly appreciate that. Thank you.
Always fun to hear from John Garland, the 2005 World Series champ. Speaking of World Series champs, on the 20th anniversary season, Jeff Blum in the house, the TV analyst for the Houston Astros, and to White Sox fans, more importantly, the man who hit the home run in Game 3 in extra innings. He'll join us next right here on ESPN 1000 and the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. I know White Sox fans love hearing that highlight, of course, from Game 3, the longest game in World Series history. And Jeff Blum, the man who homered on that highlight courtesy of Fox, he's in the booth with me right now. He has come back. He does the TV analyst work for the Astros. And, Jeff, we were just chatting a bit off the air here. And it's funny because the White Sox are, of all the teams you played, what, 14 years in the majors, roughly?
Right at 13.
Okay, so yeah. You spent plenty of time in the majors. And the White Sox are actually the team that you spent the shortest amount of time with. But you certainly left your legacy because with that homer and a World Series championship, it's the only World Series you won. It has to be pretty cool coming back to Chicago.
No, yeah, it's crazy to think that being here 3 months and having the impact with one swing like that is, that's something that's out of our hands. That's something that that you dream about, and I actually fulfilled that dream. But to be able to do it in a city like Chicago, obviously, is amazing. And to do it with that group of guys that were here in 2005 was even better. It doesn't feel like it was 20 years ago. It's amazing to me that that memory, hearing Joe Buck's voice, mm-hmm. and reminiscing about that, it does not feel like 20 years ago. It still feels like yesterday.
No, it really does. And you know, for me, I'm a lifelong White Sox fan. To have you guys do that in that season. And the dominant postseason run, Jeff, when you were going through
Nobody talks about it. It drives me crazy.
Right? Like,
yeah.
Don't even get us started about it. ESPN occasionally forgetting to put the graphic up, but I'll digress. Yeah,
shocking.
The dominant run that you guys put on in the playoffs. I mean, at what point did you – because you were traded at the trade deadline to the White Sox. At what point did you feel, all right, this is something here. I'm getting in at the perfect time.
Well, what's crazy is I was on a first-place team in San Diego when I got traded over, and I looked at the standings on July 31st when I get traded. I'm like, dude, these guys are up by 15. What the hell am I going to bring to this ball club? And I show up, and it was – I'm like, how are these guys winning this many ball games? And it was just kind of this ragtag concoction of guys that went out there. We were a mess off the field in a good way. It was highly entertaining, and they just kind of absorbed me into the mess, and it was great. It was just magical. But every time the first pitch was thrown, all of a sudden there was a gear or something that shifted in that dugout. It shifted on the field into, we don't care who's on the other side of the field. We are going to run through you as hard as we possibly can to win ball games. And then we get to the postseason and absolutely, you know, abuse the reigning World Series champions and the Boston Red Sox.
Yep.
We destroyed them in this ballpark, and then El Duque had that magical entrance and finished off a bases-loaded situation.
Hocus pocus. We'll
yeah,
never forget that moment.
It was crazy. And it looked like he floated out of the bullpen onto the field and just, you know, took care of business. But when we were sitting there after game four, after sweeping the Astros in the World Series, there was a little bit of exhaustion in it. Mm-hmm. But there was also a realization that, like, damn, dude, we just went 11-1 against the best teams in baseball. And 20 years later, I firmly believe that they do not talk about it often enough, that how dominant that team was.
No, it's one of the great reasons why I'm actually so happy to be able to be here on the 20th anniversary of that season, because we're doing a lot of retrospective this year. John Garland, Aaron Rowan were just in the booth the other day. Obviously, two key members. You mentioned it, though. It's funny because, you know, you had a lot of great players.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like there was like no clear top 10 player in baseball on that roster. It was just a bunch of guys who were good baseball players. And I think it kind of it emphasized, hey, baseball is a team game, mm-hmm. and you need everybody kind of pulling in the right direction. And it was so fun to just watch it as a Sox fan.
Yeah, and you forget about the four complete games in the ALCS against the Angels to get to the World Series. But you're right. And that game three couldn't be, you know, that was the emphasis of what you're talking about, knowing that it basically took all 25 guys to go out there and win that ball game. You know, you've got Mark Burley coming out of the bullpen and saving that game after pitching, you know, starting mm-hmm. game one. So, I mean, there were just so many things that were happening throughout the course of that series that made us realize that we were doing something special. But that's the beauty of that, too, is 20 years later, that's a bond that never will change. I've seen guys in the offseason. I've seen guys during the season. I'm mm-hmm. slapping Aaron Rowan in the back in the home TV booth. And it's not turn around, oh, hey, Jeff. It's like, come here, brother.
Give
give a big old hug. So, I mean, that's what's kind of created. Same thing with Ozzy, Harold Baines down on the field. I mean, there was a certain bond and kinship that will never be matched on that team.
Well, and the truth is that's the one thing where, like, fans, like, when your team goes on to win a World Series, like, Sox fans can basically run off that entire roster, the entire 25-man yeah. roster that was in the playoffs. And, you know, there's a lot of great players who didn't necessarily get a chance to win a World Series, who they're not the folk heroes that someone like Jeff Blum is when he comes back to town because of a home run in that moment.
Mm-hmm. No, there's guys in the Hall of Fame that will never have that have never had the opportunity to say, I played in a World Series game. And one of the funniest things is later in my career, about 2011, 2012, I think a young Paul Goldschmidt gets called up to the big leagues. He's a Houston guy, yep. grew up in the Woodlands. We start talking, and he starts rattling off some of these teams that I played on throughout the course of my career. And we get to talking about the World Series. We beat his team in the World Series. And I said, Paul, I go, you're going to run into guys that you love in this league. You're going to run into guys that you absolutely abhor and hate in this league that you want to destroy on a daily basis. But there isn't one guy in the big leagues that I did not wish could play in the World Series.
Yeah.
Just because being on that stage and realizing the hard work and how much time and effort, energy, and you know how seasons have to come together to be able to put you in that position.
Sure.
I wish everybody could, every ball player who's played at this level could get into that situation, because there was nothing like it. Never will be.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great point. Jeff Blum joining me here for a few moments on ESPN 1000, the Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. How much guff do you take from Houston being the analyst yes. on TV who actually homered against them? Now, maybe, you know, we were just talking too about how you kind of came in at the right time with this Houston squad, which yeah. is now, you know, seven straight ALCSs, a couple World Series titles. So is it easier for them now that they've won a few and they can kind of let it go?
Yeah, I got the job in 2013, and from 2013 to 2017, if I ever said just 2005,
uh-oh.
If I referenced just the year,
sure.
not what team or who was doing what, my ex or Twitter feed would get crushed. People
effing Blum. I can't believe he's an analyst for our team.
No, I there are people within the organization that were like, why did we even hire this guy?
Oh, man.
Because of that one swing. So it's taken a lot of work to be able to endear myself again to the Houston fan base. I had really good years when I played there with Houston. Obviously, I was trying my tail off to go out there and win a World Series when I was there in 2003. But I'll never apologize for that home run, because nobody ever apologized for me getting traded from Houston out of Houston. And, you know, this is how things happen. But 2017, the Astros go on their run. They're getting into the postseason, and they win the chance to go to the World Series. And I'm very good friends with A.J. Hinch.
Mm-hmm.
And you can say what you want about that 2017 team. But at that time, in that moment, I walked over to him and I said, hey, man. And I grabbed his arm and I was like, firm. I'm like, you could do me a real solid right now if you could just go ahead and win this World Series, man, because that would take a lot of heat off me. So obviously the success of the team and being able to be, you know, one of the voices on those highlights and everything that's been going on over the last 8 to 10 years has really kind of softened the blow of what happened in 2005.
Well, glad to hear that. One quick thing about this team this year. So Hunter Brown's on the mound today, and man, the last calendar year. Forget. I read Passan's piece. You know, Diesel. He's got it going on. He kind of adjusted, and since then, I don't know. I mean, it's one of those things. It's the hidden stats, right? Because his last year's April was so bad that it made last season's numbers, like, which were great. But you're like, oh, Hunter Brown's really coming on. But when you subtract what happened and you see the adjustment he made, he's might be the best pitcher in baseball.
No, and that's kind of the argument that we have. I think he should have won Pitcher of the Month. I know he's not wearing pinstripes, and that kind of enhances some of the voting that goes on in Major League Baseball.
Max Fried.
Yeah, but if you start to look at the strikeout percentages, number of strikeouts, whiffs, all the stuff that you're talking about, the peripheral numbers that you can really dig into with pitching, he is one of the best. And he made an adjustment in the middle of May last year and went on an absolute tear. But I think it's a credit to him with the, you know, you got to have the talent, you've got to have the ability, but you got to also have to have that coachability and that adaptability to go out there and say, you know what? A lot of people say my two-seamer sucks, but you know what? I'm desperate. I'm going to make it work. He made it work, and it's completely changed his repertoire and opened up both sides of the plate for him. And he's fantastic, and he's really created this bulldog mentality.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost this this primal anger when he's on the mound sometimes.
Yeah.
Before, you know, May of last year, he would miss a spot or not get a call, and he would just implode. He'd walk around the mound, and all of a sudden he'd try and throw a better pitch, and it'd go to the backstop.
Yeah.
This year, he's not getting that pitch, and he's like, you know what? I'm going to come back with something a little bit better in the zone, and he gets the wipeout pitch. But Diesel is a very good moniker for him.
It's interesting because, like, that's like somewhat the lost art of pitching, right?
Yeah.
Everything is so about, okay, we're going to tunnel it. It needs to come from the same location, all this, all that. But the lost art of pitching, you know, the romantic in me, the old baseball fan's like,
it's still there.
Yeah.
It's still going to play.
But that's the thing is, like, you see what Hunter Brown's doing, and it's like, hey, you can't forget what got you here sometimes because it's not all about, hey, you're all robots, right?
Yeah, well, I don't know how many people, you know, like you said, tunneling, shapes, profiles. I mean, there's so many different words to describe what these guys are doing. But there was a lot of talk about his two-seam. Oh, it doesn't have the shape. It doesn't profile as a two-seamer. But it's just a flat pitch that runs in on right-handed hitters. And he needed something to get to the inside.
Yeah.
Because he would throw his four-seamer, and he didn't have the ability to get a strike on the inside or a chase. So the two-seamers really allowed him to get in on right-handed hitters. And what that's done is it stood up the right-handed hitter, and the guy goes, okay, I've got to face 97 coming on my knuckles. And then all of a sudden, I've got to go, okay, once I cover that, oh, crap, he just went to the outside with his cutter, slider, curveball.
Yeah.
And so it's opened up just a whole different avenue for him to go out and actually, like you just said, pitch.
Yes.
Yeah, crazy concept.
Yeah, right. And how about just making – the best in the world, the best hitters in the world, a little bit more uncomfortable, right, when you're in the box?
Well, isn't that, I mean, you watch enough baseball. I mean, the one thing that you hear when you talk to the old salty guys is like, back in my day, we pitched inside, you'd back a guy up, and there's really not, you know, Cannon was a good guy last night, watching him throw his two-seamer in.
Yes.
You know, you've got to have something that gets to the inside, because the second I, as a hitter, I start to step onto the plate and cover the whole thing, then I got the advantage, and he's taken that advantage away by having that pitch on the inside.
Great stuff. Jeff Blum, appreciate you jumping on. Of course, anytime. White Sox fans love hearing you, so it's fun to reminisce. Thanks for joining us here on White Sox Weekly.
No, great being here. I appreciate you.
Our pleasure. That is Jeff Blum. You know him, White Sox fans, hero from Game 3. Sox fans, the new City Connect uniforms are here, celebrating the legacy of the White Sox and the Bulls. This look honors Chicago's impact on both the diamond and court. Catch the team in the iconic uniforms every Friday night this season. Grab tickets and shop the full collection at the White Sox team store. For more info, head to whitesox.com/city. I'm Jeff Meller. This is White Sox Weekly. We'll go around the majors with some MLB news and notes before we actually hear from Jonathan Cannon, who Jeff Blum just talked about there in a minute. Cannon at 11:30, and we'll give you some MLB news and notes coming up next right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
One. That ball's drilled deep right field. Riley Green sends it over the wall. It is gone. The Tigers lead. Green powers this ball high in the air, right center field. Riley Green does it again. Two in the inning.
Two in the inning for Riley Green. Two in the ninth inning for Riley Green. And the Tigers beat the Angels late last night after they headed to the ninth, tied at one. Riley Green became the first hitter in Major League Baseball history to homer twice in the ninth inning. Now, players have homered twice in the same inning before, but Riley Green became the first player to ever do it twice in the ninth inning, and what looked like it was going to be a tight game turned into an absolute blowout for the Tigers, who are atop the AL Central. They have been really good as of late, and last night was no exception, although it did have to be tested later in the game. Tarek Skubal pitched well for them through the first six innings that he went, but ultimately he did not get a win because the Tigers, as I said, were tied up at one heading into the ninth before they end up eventually winning that game 9-1. How about this too? A bit of a Javier Baez renaissance going on. He's got a career-long six-game extra base hit streak going, and he's now manning center field, which is interesting because he played center field for the first time this year, earlier this season, against the White Sox. He went in as they switched around. There was a defensive replacement. Javier Baez, I believe, started the game at third and then moved from third to center field. And at that point earlier this season when the White Sox played the Tigers, it was the first time he had played center in the major leagues at this point in his career. So Javier Baez doing that is pretty interesting, and he's kind of figured it out just a little bit. And by the way, his Riley Green's two home runs in the same inning that we came back from, the last Tiger to do that, this name will sound familiar to you, White Sox, Maglio Ordonez. He did that in the second inning against the Athletics on August 12th in 2007. So interesting stuff going on there. Also around baseball, Bobby Witt Jr.'s 22-game hitting streak was snapped. The Jose Ramirez actually left last night's game for the Guardians. He had an ankle as he was trying to beat out a throw to first base. I believe he was actually safe, but when he stepped in the bag, he sprained his ankle. So we'll see. He might have a day off today. We'll check on that, see if I get a lineup for you and give you an update regarding him. Speaking of, though, tough plays at first base, in Boston, Tristan Casas suffered a serious knee injury trying to beat out an infield hit. Now, he ended up being stretchered off after his knee buckled when he collapsed as his foot hit the bag. That is a serious injury. Alex Cora said that, you know, obviously he was stretchered off, so not good at all for him. And you wonder, you just fear, you hope it's not the worst, but certainly wouldn't be surprised if his season is over. Not going to speculate, but it was definitely a scary sight in Boston last night. Alex Bregman continues to rake at Fenway. He signed there, and everyone knew that he had a history of absolutely tearing up Fenway Park. And now that he calls it home, he has absolutely been a monster there this season for the Red Sox. How about Cal Raleigh? He hit two more home runs last night for the Mariners, including a grand slam against the Rangers. And Cal Raleigh is quietly, I think, becoming the Mariners' best player. While everybody was kind of waiting for Julio Rodriguez to potentially be a top five, top 10 player in baseball, not Julio Rodriguez is great. There's no doubt about it, but he hasn't necessarily ascended to the way some people around baseball thought he would, you know, put himself in the conversation as top five player in baseball. He's still a great player, but, you know, I think most people would agree he hasn't really hit that spot yet. Cal Raleigh, what he's doing as a defensive catcher, he is one of the best in the league. And for a long time, for the last couple of years, I guess, it was just, okay, is he just a guy who hits for power, but, you know, with a batting average that hovered around 200, could he really be, how good of a player could he be? Well, this year he's continued to excel, and now Cal Raleigh has an on-base percentage hovering around 350. He leads the majors in home runs with 12, and he really has helped fuel the Mariners' race atop the AL West, and he's been able to do that with the absence of a couple of key pitchers for the Mariners. Both George Kirby and Logan Gilbert are on the IL right now. So what Cal Raleigh's been able to do is really impressive. Kyle Schwarber for the Phillies, he homered. He extended his on-base streak to 38 games, dating all the way back to last season. And one more note, or actually, let me give you two more. Fernando Tatis Jr. left the game for the Padres last night. He was hit by a pitch in the left arm. He had a huge welt on his left arm. He left the game with an injury. And then Gunnar Hoglund, he was very impressive in his major league debut for the Athletics. He got the win, six fabulous innings of one-run ball, struck out seven without a walk for a surprising A's team. Yeah, the Mariners and the A's, the two teams that are right now atop the AL West. And I think with the Astros in town, most people just assumed they would be the team that would easily be the favorites in the AL West, or maybe the Texas Rangers. Well, the Rangers can't seem to score any runs. Jake Berger was just sent to AAA as they try and figure out what's been going on with him. Big addition for the Rangers, and a former White Sox as well. Well, the Rangers are 16-17, the Astros are 16-15, but the A's are 18-15, and the Mariners are just on fire at 19-12. So interesting stuff going on around baseball last night. Hey, White Sox fans, join us at the ballpark next Saturday, May 10th, as the White Sox take on the Marlins at 6:10 p.m. The first 15,000 fans, 21 and older, will receive a 1940s varsity sweater presented by Blue Moon. To purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/promos. All right, when we come back here on White Sox Weekly, expecting to hear from Sox winning pitcher last night, Jonathan Cannon. We'll do that next right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. Jeff Meller back here on White Sox Weekly and the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network, live at Rate Field, hanging out with you. We Just heard from Jeff Blum, World Series hero from 2005, a little bit earlier. If you missed a fantastic interview with Blummer, the Astros TV analyst. Again, you can always, if you jump in late, we always post the White Sox Weekly podcast on the ESPN Chicago app. So you can always get that there. And as I mentioned, we were expecting to hear from Jonathan Cannon, last night's winner, and the winner of the last two times he's gone out and pitched. Jonathan Cannon joining me here on White Sox Weekly. I'm Jeff Meller. Jonathan, fantastic outing last night and on the heels of your performance against the Athletics in Sacramento. I'd say you've got things rolling, my man.
Yeah, you know, stuff's feeling good, and I kind of mentioned it last night, but, you know, it really is just been a lot simpler, just getting ahead, staying ahead. That was kind of the key, kind of what I wanted to improve on from the first month, and was able to do that yesterday.
So is there anything in particular? You said you felt good. Is it something, a tweak you've made, or is it just the warmer weather, just getting in a rhythm? Anything in particular that you can pinpoint?
Well, it wasn't too much warmer last night.
That's true. That's true.
But no, I mean, it's really just, you know, it's early in the year. You're trying to get the feel down for everything. Just trying to improve start to start. I've always kind of prided myself on being a strike thrower. So the fact that I was walking guys and kind of falling behind wasn't really my identity. So I wanted to really get back to getting ahead, being the aggressor. And you know what, that's kind of the difference, where if I walk guys yesterday, some of those, I gave up a lot of hits, those hits turn into runs. So being able to give up those hits and still get out of it was huge.
Jonathan Cannon joining me here on White Sox Weekly. Jonathan, I do want to commend you, because that second inning, listen, pitchers oftentimes, their fielders will pick them up. Every once in a while, there'll be a moment when the fielding hit lets them down and the pitchers pick them up. You really bared down and did a nice job in the second inning to get through that. Is there anything mentally you tell yourself in those moments when you feel like, you know, I'm in a bad spot here? How do you kind of get through it and push through it and do what you did to get through that inning scoreless?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of that, too, just comes with a little bit more experience. And realizing and understanding that the errors are part of the game. No one's perfect. Those guys picked me up, like you said, so many times. Vargas ended up picking me up there in the sixth inning with the huge cut to get the guy at second after I gave up the hit. But, I mean, you just can't get too far ahead of yourself. You know, you got runners in scoring position, less than two outs. You can't get too far ahead of yourself. What's the number one thing you can do as a pitcher? Like, is stay present and go pitch to pitch. Like, the one thing that you're trying to do, okay, like, I got to execute this pitch right here. I need strike one, and then go from there. Like, you can't look too far ahead and be like, oh, I need a strikeout. Next thing you know, you blink, you're 2-0, 3-1, 3-0 behind the guy, and then you get into a point where you have to throw a strike to a good hitter, and that's where you end up getting burned. So just trying to stay ahead of the hitter, execute the pitches one pitch at a time is usually the best way to go about that.
You had success last night in your only other start of your career against the Astros. Last season, you had a lot of success as well. Is there anything in particular, or is that just a coincidence that you've pitched so well against this lineup?
No, I mean, I think it really, I don't think it's too much of a coincidence. I mean, I think that this is a very talented lineup. There's a lot of continuity between last year and this year. A lot of similar guys in the lineup. But I really think me and Caro did a really good job last night of just kind of mixing and matching. Last year, I think I probably threw those guys a lot of sweepers. And I felt like they were kind of looking for that early in the game. We went to the changeup. We were able to keep them off balance, get a lot of weak contact. Even though we gave up some hits, a lot of those hits were kind of weak contact on pretty good pitches. So I really think we executed the game plan well. I think that credit goes to Caro, too, with the preparation that he did and kind of reading some of the swings of the hitters and making sure that we were on the same page.
You mentioned Edgar Caro. White Sox fans, I think, have all been really pleasantly surprised. Not that there weren't a lot of expectations, but when a kid comes up, makes his debut, hits well, and then as a catcher, you know, we know defense is probably more important for a catcher than the actual bat, but to be able to bring a bat and now to hear you talk about, you know, his preparation, and it wasn't just, you know, last night, but he was also catching for you last Saturday when we were going against the Athletics. So talk about, you know, how impressed you've been with Edgar Caro's work ethic as a catcher behind the plate for you.
Yeah, I mean, I think the catching position is easily one of the probably the hardest position to play in this game. You got the offensive side, and you're dealing with 13 pitchers, and we're all stubborn, and we're all tough to work with. And so the fact that he's able to prepare and understand what's working, what's not, and being able to adjust on the fly. We adjusted our game plan last night kind of in the second, third inning. And so being able to see all that, I think really just speaks to just his composure. And I mean, he's a young kid up in the big leagues playing the hardest position, and he just is so composed back there. And I think that just speaks to all the work he's put in. I think it speaks to the coaches. Drew Butera, our catching coach, I think he's done a great job with him. And then you have Corey Lee and Matt Theis behind the scenes also mentoring him. So I think it just kind of speaks to everyone in the organization. They've done a great job. Caro's done a great job. He's hitting well at the plate. He's very fun to watch. I'm looking forward to continuing to throw to him and down the road.
Jonathan Cannon joining me here on White Sox Weekly and the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. Jonathan, last Saturday, you gave us your deepest performance of the season, but it was not in a starting effort. It was actually in relief because the White Sox went with the opener that they did for four games in a row there. So for you as a normal starter, did it throw your routine off at all a little bit? Did you like your experience coming in as the bulk guy? How did that play out for you last Saturday? Because obviously you had a successful outing in that one.
Yeah, I mean, I think all of us, we all view ourselves as starting pitchers. We're very routine oriented. We like staying in our routine and being able to start those games. But we also understand what Will is and the coaching staff are trying to do. The communication line was open in the weeks leading up to them employing the opener, and we really appreciated that. Like we're professional baseball players. We can adjust to anything and do what they want. But having that line of communication was something that we really appreciated, and being able to talk through it and what kind of situations we would use it in. And at the end of the day, it comes down to Will's decision. He's in charge of the lineup card, and we respect what he's trying to do to put us in a position to win. And it worked out for us. We played really well with those openers. We didn't win all of them, but I thought it put all of us in a good position. But obviously, we enjoy starting and being able to stay in that routine.
Yeah, so I agree with you. I think even though maybe the results weren't perfect the way you'd want, the way they drew it up certainly did seem to be successful. So talk to me just a little bit about as a starting pitcher. You know, most starting pitchers, at least from my experience, you've got that bulldog mentality. It's like, hey, it's my day on the mound. Jump on my shoulders. I'm going to lead this team to victory. So, but as we've, you know, we're now, I don't know, almost a decade into the idea of using openers. So I have to imagine as you were growing up watching the game unfold, you were a little more familiar with the idea of it. So is it just something that starting pitchers maybe can welcome a little bit more than maybe they did in the past with the idea that, hey, this gives the team the best chance for success?
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea of the opener, it really comes down to the top of the order of the opposing team and how they choose to line it up. I think that it definitely makes sense in some areas, but also like just being able, like starting pitchers, like you said, like on our start day, we're locked in, we're looking to go from the start, and sometimes, you know, being in the bullpen throws off that routine a little bit.
Yeah.
But once again, we're all winners. We all want to win. We all want to celebrate with the team after. And however we get to that win, we're game for. And we don't get caught up too much in how we get there. We just want to get there. And so whatever it kind of takes to win those ball games, we're game for.
Jonathan Cannon joining me for another moment here on White Sox Weekly. All right, Jonathan, what did you think Thursday afternoon watching it from a different perspective, seeing Luis Robert go over the wall and rob Rhys Hoskins of what would have been a potential grand slam for Sean Burke?
Oh, I mean, on the mound, I mean, that is what dreams are made of right there. And that's the kind of thing, like, you don't make a great pitch. The guy barrels one. You got the bases loaded and two outs, and you're kind of sitting there. Your eyes are looking at the ball. You're looking at the fence. you're seeing that Luis Robert's running out of room, and you're like, oh man, you kind of hold your breath, and he jumps up and grabs it, and wow, I mean, that changed the whole game. I mean, Luis Robert is easily the best center fielder that I've ever seen. I mean, just the balls that he gets to is incredible. We're starting to see him heat up with the bat. I mean, he's probably the most complete player that I've ever played with. Mm-hmm. So to be able to watch him every day, especially defensively, is he's so fun to watch, and it's awesome. Any ball that goes out to center field, it doesn't matter how hard it's hit, I think it's going to be caught. And I think that propelled Burke into then throwing 6 shutout innings. I mean, that was a humongous play in the game. And I mean, wow. I mean, and it seems like we see him do it once a week, a play like that.
No doubt about it. Last thing here, did you enjoy getting the win in the new City Connect jersey last night that you were sporting on the mounds?
Oh, these jerseys are awesome. I mean, I don't think the pictures kind of do it justice for how they look when we're wearing them out on the field. Kind of looking back at it last night, those uniforms are awesome. I know a lot of fans, and me included, were a little sad to see the Southside uniforms go, but I think the marketing team and design team did an absolutely unbelievable job with these new uniforms. They're awesome. The gear is awesome. All the stuff that kind of goes into it. Just so many Easter eggs in the jersey, too. There's so much behind it, and not just what you see just in the collar and the hat,
yes,
on the pants, everything. They did such a fantastic job, and I think it really just kind of – I think this has been the full embodiment of what a City Connect was meant to be.
No, that's a great, great endorsement, Jonathan. I'm glad you mentioned that there are a lot of great Easter eggs for people to go out there and check out. So maybe take a closer look next time you see one and you're looking to maybe pick one up at the Sox store. Jonathan, you made the jersey look that much better last night with your performance. Thanks for hopping on White Sox Weekly today.
Yep, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
That is Jonathan Cannon, the winning pitcher from last night's game. White Sox on a 2-game winning streak. Up next, James Fegan joins me, and we'll get some big picture thoughts on the White Sox organization when we come back right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. Welcome back to White Sox Weekly. I'm Jeff Meller here at Wright Field as we're getting set for White Sox and Astros coming your way with a 1:10 first pitch. And my pleasure now to be joined by the man from the Sox Machine. You can also read his stuff on Fangraphs. Baseball America does a lot of prospect writing as well, which I know a lot of White Sox fans are kind of diving into these days. It is James Fegan. You know him. All right, James. So, you know what? Let's start with Colson Montgomery, because that happened earlier this weekend, and I think for a lot of White Sox fans, that's the big picture item that might be most alarming and concerning. When Chris Getz told us on Tuesday, hey, by the way, a little announcement here, just in case we forgot to tell you, Colson Montgomery is going to head over to Arizona, and he's going to work with Ryan Fuller with some one-on-one individual work to fix a mechanical issue in his swing. I'm not going to lie, that took me aback a little bit. What were your thoughts?
I mean, it's certainly Colson has struggled to get to this point where they felt that it was necessary. Like, it's not a good sign that that's happening, but it's a proactive measure to take in response to what I think we could plainly see in terms of his numbers and just the strikeouts being elevated to a point that they hadn't been before in his professional career, that there's things he needs to work on. And certainly having the back spasms in spring didn't help as far as him getting rhythm and timing. But I think just fundamentally, like, Colson got drafted as a 19-year-old. You know, he's coming out of high school. Mm-hmm. His body has changed. He's gotten taller. He's gotten bigger. He's gotten stronger since he first got drafted. His swing has changed along with it. So there's a lot of like mechanical stuff that they kind of need to. He's just a fundamentally different hitter than he was in 2022 and 2023, where he's really breaking out. I think he's going to be more of a power hitter, like power over hit, in the sense of maybe a lower average guy who, you know, has the potential, certainly with the exit velocity we see, to probably hit 30 bombs, like, if things really click for him. But it's going to be a kind of a little different formulation to really get him to that point. And I think maybe the initial image of him being like this guy who walked more than he struck out in the early low minors, that's probably not as realistic. But getting him to be a guy who really just gets to his power really regularly, he can still be a very impactful player. I think it's just the image of what he's going to be and the mechanics behind it has changed in such a way that they have to address it the way they're doing. And clearly just kind of having him hit his head against the wall in AAA wasn't the best way for him to get there.
Yeah, no, I mentioned it a couple times. I think the strikeout rate had hit 41.7%, which obviously is unsustainable at the minor league, major league level, much less the minor league level. So, no, I guess that makes sense. What about long-term-wise defensively? Do you think he can stay at shortstop, or do you think ultimately he's probably a third baseman most likely?
I think he can stay at shortstop if they want him to be, at least for like the, you know, in his 20s. Mm-hmm. I think like he's not going to have the foot speed of a normal person you put there. I think it'd be pretty hard for him to be like a top end shortstop. But as far as like passable, getting away with it, yeah, I think he could do that for mm-hmm. a few years. And certainly with like the talent allotment, you don't necessarily like there's Jacob Gonzalez, there's Caleb Bottomer. Those guys are probably far away. You could probably you have Chase Mydroff playing there now, doing fine. I don't know if you necessarily have like the sure thing other shortstop prospect that you would turn to and play there every day. So I get their inclination for it, but certainly like if he gets to his like late 20s and 30s, you could see him moving over to third. Or you know, some scouts have said he could be a corner outfielder, or you know, certainly like later part of his career, first base. But as far as like getting away with like shortstop, he won't be like an asset there, where his defense is like part of like the big how he's creating value. Other than the fact that like if you have a good hitter at shortstop, that's valuable. But I think he could do it for a couple of years if that's what they need.
Yeah,
I don't think it's like he's going to be a Gold Glover there. He's just like bigger and a little bit slower than you normally see at the position. But it also gives him a little bit of range. He's certainly got the arm for it. He had great throws in spring training. There are some strengths he brings to that position where he can get away with it. I just don't think it's like, you know, Ozzie Smith there at any point.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Or Jacob Amaya.
Right, like that's a guy who really kind of makes his living. It's been cool how they've used him the last couple of games where he's like a closer defensively. They bring him on and he really shines. Like he's not going to be that level defender there, but he can be a guy that maybe you play the first six innings at short, and then if you're in the lead, you should switch to a more defensively minded guy.
I'll admit, watching Jacob Amaya this season, I certainly never thought I could get as much joy watching a guy play just defense the way I have with Jacob Amaya this year because of the way, unfortunately, he struggles with the bat. But yeah, defensively, he certainly earned his keep around here. James Fegan of the Sox Machine joining me here on White Sox Weekly. He also, don't forget, if you are unaware, he has a White Sox pregame preview that is free to the public. So if they want to get that, James, what's the easiest way to check out the preview?
Just SoxMachine.com. It'll be once, like, I think we'll probably post it like 20 minutes before the game starts every day. Usually I have a couple notes from the Venable pregame session or stuff I picked up today, like, you know, Ethan Katz talking about Davis Martin throwing a new slider this afternoon. So that'll be stuff we kind of try to give you something that, you know, suggests, gives you a preview of what you're going to see on the ball field, as unpredictable as it is. We do our best.
Yeah, no, love it. So that's interesting. So Davis Martin going to work with a new slider today. What do you think about that when you heard Ethan Katz reveal that to you today?
Well, like when Davis first came up in 2022, like his slider was his best pitch, mm-hmm. and you know, it was something he would throw even more than his fastball. And now we've seen like the kick change kind of take over, and they felt his slider had gotten a little sweepy and slower and just wasn't getting the chase numbers that they had seen. So he's throwing to something that's a little bit harder, a little bit more, you know, like vertical drop on it than, you know, side to side movement. And they tried it in a bullpen, and they feel pretty good about it. It's probably going to be a little bit higher velo. So it could be interesting. Look, we've certainly seen. Certainly, I thought Davis Martin looked very good at stretches of 2022, where he's really just pitching off that slider. So if he's, it's probably a bit more work about getting back to that than like, oh man, something really crazy new, like a knuckleball that he's never thrown before. But it seems like a new grip adjustment has like, hopefully getting him back to the place where he was, you know, earlier in his career where he was living off of that. Now, obviously, he doesn't need to live off that now because he's got a 92-mile-an-hour changeup.
Yeah.
But getting back to some of the elements that he had in his game before he had to lean on the kick change as much as he does now.
Interesting. James Fegan joining me here on White Sox Weekly. So what do you make of what you've seen from the rotation so far that they've put together? All in all, I have to admit, you know, I've been pleasantly surprised, even though the record obviously hasn't necessarily reflected what the organization was hoping for in terms of improvement. I still have to admit, like, for the most part, game in and game out, at least until Martin Perez was injured, I felt like every day you were like, okay, you know what? I could see situations here where they can get through six innings pretty, you know, pretty clean and have a chance to win ball games. So have you been impressed with the rotation as a whole?
Yeah, I think they've been pretty solid. Shane Smith has obviously been like a you know, breakout candidate and, you know, as good as he possibly could have hoped for any Rule 5 pick to be. Like long term, the people that they expect to be the top of this rotation are like in double A.
Yes,
like
yes.
The people who are like front of the rotation stuff. This is like a kind of a year to find out, like, can this guy be in the rotation? Could he be like a number three starter? Could he be a number four starter? Could he be someone who starts a playoff game at some point? Not necessarily, oh man, we got to find our future ace right now, but like a bunch of guys, like, can this guy stick? Can this guy hang? And I think you've kind of seen that even without like anybody really touting a big fastball or being overpowering or even like having big strikeout rates. It's not everyone's like throwing like a sub four ERA like, you know, Davis Martin is, but I think you've seen flashes from everybody. You're like, this guy could definitely help. I don't know exactly what the role will be. I don't know exactly what the playoff spot in the rotation will be. You know, maybe some of these guys are like really good relievers at some point down the road even, but I think you've seen kind of the concept of why they wanted to try out things with this guy with pretty much everyone in the rotation. It's definitely a blow to lose Martin Perez because that's someone that they felt they could push more innings-wise than any of these guys who are all in their first or second year starting. Like, I think especially as the season goes on, you're going to see kind of more cautious handling of Shane Smith and you know, being aware of guys' innings as they add up in a way that might involve more guys getting involved in this rotation. Certainly seemed like Mike Clevinger getting a start in Charlotte the other day. That's something they might have to use down the road, or, you know, Tyler Schweitzer coming up like at some point late in the season if he clicks in Charlotte. But as far as kind of what you're looking for, what you're hoping for, the type of progress you're hoping to see, I think it's been good even without, you know, having the overpowering stuff that makes you think like, oh, this is a future star. I think you've seen a lot of future contributors.
Last thing I want to spring you because I know you've got Paul Janish who you want to go catch on the Zoom. But all right, the Tim Elko question. Sox fans can't help themselves. Andrew Vaughn struggling. Tim Elko is your minor league player of the month as a hitter. Your thoughts on when Sox fans might realistically see Elko at the major league level?
I think, like, for sure you see him, like, post-trade deadline, which feels, like, crazy long for a guy he's, like, bashing right now. Certainly, like, they're not – their original plan coming to the season was certainly not to bail on Andrew Vaughn in, like, early May. And I certainly think Tim Elko's kind of forced his way in the picture rather than, like, when he was drafted as a senior sign for, like, $35K that they were like, oh, this is our future first baseman. He's kind of had to prove it at every stop. So I think it's going to not be as responsive to, hey, he's hot, call him up, that they would be for Edgar Caro, someone who, like, once they got him, was like, well, this is going to be a future contributor. So it's going to be a slower boil than I feel fans would want, especially because in the first half of the year for a team like this, you're trying to, like, build trade assets.
Yeah.
You're trying to, like, see, like, hey, can we kind of show this veterans back in working order? Like, Brandon Drury hasn't played since he got hit by a pitch, you know, last week.
But, yeah.
Like, that might be someone you're more interested in from the White Sox perspective to see, like, hey, is this guy back to, like, what he was? Then, like, Tim Elko, you're knowing those last 2 months of the season, we're going to play a ton of youth. There's going to be plenty of room to, like, really find out if this guy is real. I don't know if it'll necessarily be that long, especially with the way he's hitting. You know, if injuries crop up or there's some sort of need, and it's not like swapping out for Andrew Vaughn's the only way Tim Elko could get on the roster or have at-bats.
Yeah.
But I don't think that their plan was originated towards, like, let's put in our youth right away in the first, you know, 2 months of the season. I think he'd really have to force his way to do that. It's probably safer to seem like, well, definitely, if somebody's hitting in Charlotte, we're going to see them in August and September at some point, if not July. So I don't know if they feel like a rush to do that. It could be sooner, but I think that the fact that it'll definitely be later
after the trade
takes some a little of their urgency away.
All right, you got places to go. Thanks for hopping on, James. Appreciate it, man.
Thanks,
James Fegan of the Sox Machine. You can follow him on X at JR Fegan. He does great coverage for White Sox. If you want information, you want more prospect stuff, he has great stuff there, and also FanGraphs Baseball America. So check out all his great stuff. Keeps me more informed about the White Sox, which I appreciate. Plenty to come right here on White Sox Weekly on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.
Sox fans, be here on Friday, June 27th, to see artist Flo Rida perform a post-game concert presented by Coca-Cola after the White Sox take on the Giants at 6:40. Don't miss your chance for an up-close on-field experience. Exclusive on-field passes are on sale now with limited availability. To purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/concert. All right, Tim Elko, no surprise because he has absolutely been mashing. He had 9 home runs, an OPS over 1,100 last month. And oh, by the way, he started May out pretty well with a home run last night. Tim Elko, what has been working so well for him?
Yeah, just kind of been working with Jim here and Rosie and You know, we've had Fuller and Zinter in here as well, but just, you know, trying to work on pitch selection and just making sure I'm getting good pitches to swing at and swing at the right ones and doing damage when I get them in my zone.
How are you able to kind of make that change, which the Sox, you know, have talked about? We talked to Ryan Fuller last week in Sacramento. He mentioned that, but, you know, keep what makes your game strong and, you know, kind of have a melding of the two.
Yeah, no, I mean, I got to work with Fuller all spring training and he's awesome. He's the best. And, you know, I got to work on the traject down there in Arizona as well, which I think was a big help. You know, just being able to see pitches and, you know, do something that's difficult. And I think it helps you in the long run. And yeah, so he kind of helped to perfect that. And, you know, that helps me swing at those correct pitches.
Something Ryan mentioned that I thought was interesting is he felt that you working on swing decisions and swinging less outside the zone has made you better in the zone. And how have you kind of seen that translate to where you're making even better contact on pitches in the zone now that you're kind of more locked into that area?
Yeah, for sure. You know, when you're on time and ready for those pitches in the zone, it's a lot easier to take the ones outside the zone as well. So, you know, just being selective and, you know, really just zoning in on the pitches that I'm looking for and hunting that helps to make it easier to not swing at those bad ones as well. So, yeah, just zoning in on where I'm looking and makes it easier to take the bad ones.
You mentioned the traject, but just also just how much has machine work kind of, I guess, supercharged this process of really improving a lot of areas in your offensive game?
Yeah, like I was saying before, you know, just making sure that I'm on time for every pitch, and you know, you're not going to be perfect. You're still going to miss some pitches, yeah, using the machine and traject and all those different tools to just hone in those skills and make sure my timing's good, because you know, most of the time when somebody's struggling, a lot of it's just timing. So making sure I'm on time to be able to swing at any pitch, that's when you're at your best.
Tim Elko there talking about what has been working so well for him so far to start the season. More from Elko on being part of a talented Sox farm system.
We're having a lot of fun down here. We've got a great group of guys, not only here in Charlotte, but I know there's lots of great guys down at the other levels as well. So, you know, we're just having fun here, trying to win some games and you know, we mesh well together and we have a good time. And yeah, I think that's a big part of it is culture. And I think we're building a great culture throughout the minors and I think up in the big leagues as well. And, you know, I think it's just fun to play together and, you know, just be able to compete every night with some of your best friends. You know, it makes a big difference and makes it a lot more fun winning.
What are you maybe you're not even thinking about it, but what do you take some kind of pride in being a bit of a leader by example kind of guy like that goes about his business and can be part of building that culture and part of building that vibe?
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, you know, I just try to be the best that I can every day for the guys around me and, you know, do whatever I can to help us win. And, you know, it's not really about me, you know, it's about us. And I kind of take pride in that mentality and, you know, just trying to be the same guy every day and, you know, be a good example and just go out and try to give it 110% every time I step on the field and help us win in any way I can.
One more from Tim Elko, and this might be the one that White Sox fans will be excited to hear. He was asked specifically, hey, do you feel like you're major league ready?
Yeah, I mean, you know, whenever that opportunity arises, you know, I'll be ready. And but right now I'm just trying to focus on where my feet are and, you know, not look ahead too much. But you know, just try to continue to perfect my craft and, you know, be the best player I can every single day here. And you know, like I said, just be where my feet are. You know, when that time comes or that opportunity comes, you know, I'll be ready. But, like I said, just trying to be where my feet are and enjoy where I'm at right now.
Is this kind of the best you felt during your time with the White Sox?
Yeah. I mean, I guess you could say that. You know, it was, like he had mentioned before, you know, a cool little 10 stretch of games with some homers. You know, obviously that's cool and everything. But, yeah, no, I mean, I feel good. And like I said, just trying to go out and compete every day and help us win games.
Are you surprised, though, that you haven't, just the way you hit and what the team needs, that they haven't called you up? Have you talked to people in the organization, whether it's Getz or people in the minor leagues, about what their plan is and if, you know, they are going to bring you up anytime soon?
No, I don't really dig into that kind of stuff too much. just try to kind of focus on what I'm doing here right now, and you know, just trying to improve every single day and be the best that I can for the Charlotte Knights right now. And like I said, whenever the opportunity arises, you know, I'll be ready. And I'm just trying to focus on who I am right now and getting better here every single day.
Now, everyone, once they're in pro ball, they, you know, the goal is to get to the majors. But, you know, in being big league camp the last couple of years, or, you know, having success in AAA now, is there a point where it started to feel like more realistic, or you start seeing like, all right, I've played against the highest level guys, and, you know, I've seen my skills translate, where it started to feel like this is something that could happen to me, where it started to feel like it was in sight?
Yeah. No, I mean, I know what you're saying. Yeah, for sure. You know, I feel like, you know, I've been able to improve some of my weak areas that I've had the last couple of years, and, you know, just continuing to try to get those better every single day. And, you know, it's some of the stuff's out of your control. And so, like I said, I'm just trying to be where my feet are. And, you know, I see the light at the end of the tunnel, but again, I'm still just focusing on where I am right now and continue to try to be the best that I can, so that when I get my opportunity, you know, I can perform.
Tim Elko there, again, the White Sox minor league hitter of the month for April. Hey, Sox fans, join us at the ballpark for Family Sundays presented by Coca-Cola. Tickets starting at only $10. Enjoy Kids Run the Bases postgame, caricature artists, and more. To learn more and purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/Sunday. So Elko was the hitter of the month in the minor leagues for the White Sox, and Grant Taylor was the pitcher of the month for the White Sox in their minor league system down at AA Birmingham, with some other very highly touted prospects, those being Noah Schultz and Hagen Smith in the very same rotation. We'll let you hear from Grant Taylor on those two in a moment. But first off, let's start out by letting you know what Grant Taylor believes is working for him.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. I was really happy with how I did in spring training, and I felt that it was going to be a good springboard for the season, and I feel like it has so far. Found a lot of confidence, you know, pitching to some of the guys in big league camp, and I think it's been good so far, and be a lot more fun going forward.
Just what's been the most effective for you so far, particularly these last handful of outings as well?
I think my cutter has been huge for me the past couple of outings. Falling behind on some guys and been able to use it in some in-between counts to get some soft contact or get back fighting. And, you know, been able to use it early and late in the count too. I think it's been a really good weapon for me so far.
Grant Taylor talked about being in the rotation with both Hagen Smith and Noah Schultz.
Oh, it's been a lot of fun. Those guys are both extremely hard workers, both winners. And I think that can only add to my game, being around them, watching how they work, watching their mindset, you know, getting to watch Schultz, you know, go six innings for the first time in pro ball. And, you know, he's 98 on his 93rd pitch, like seeing him fired up after that's like, it can only help everyone in the dugout to be around that and see that.
Is that a good thing? I think they've talked about this as you guys develop, is, you know, having guys together, is that kind of benefit to have, you know, group pockets of players together coming up together through the system?
Yeah, I think so. You know, both Hagen and Schultz are, I think they're number one and number two and left-handed pitching prospects. So, like, you know, that's something to compete with, you know, if friendship to friend, like friend to friend, you know, you always want to, you know, stack good days on each other and see who comes out on top. So I think it's really good for all of us because there's, you know, friendly competition, you know, within the team, and there's also competition that we get to go after, you know, every 5 days, every 6 days. So I think it can only be a benefit for us to be together and learn from each other.
One more here from Grant Taylor, again, the White Sox minor league pitcher of the month. He talked about what's been the difference for him in terms of double A this year versus last season.
Double A hitters are just better. Like, that's why they're in double A. They don't swing at balls near as much. They hit strikes a lot more, which, I mean, that kind of goes without saying there. But, you know, they're just better. So you get away with a lot less. You kind of get away with a couple things more because they're not quite swinging as often. You know, sometimes my stuff was just really good that day, and I could get away with a lot more. And the double A hitters kind of hold me a little bit more honest, so I have to work on more things.
I guess what you're talking about with them being a bit more patient, you know, it's less about using chase pitches and more about kind of having to work to get ahead and stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, you have to be in zone early. Like you can't, there's not going to be as many, you know, oh chases, oh one chases, that puts you, you know, oh two. And so then oh two, it's kind of your ball game. You know, you see that at the big league level a lot. Like those guys really don't swing out of the zone a good, like a lot. So you have to be, you have to trust your stuff in zone a lot more than you do at lower levels. And I think that, you know, adds to the game and it makes it more fun because it's more like my best on your best. Like, let's get after it.
That is Grant Taylor, who was named the White Sox Pitcher of the Month yesterday. And again, along with Tim Elko, who you heard right before him, the White Sox Hitter of the Month. Again, just some really good stuff from both those minor league prospects who White Sox fans are very, very excited about, no doubt. Good reason why. If you're unfamiliar, Grant Taylor has a .79 ERA in his four starts. He's pitched 11 and one-third innings. He's struck out 14 over that time. Hitters are only hitting 111 off of him, so he's been absolutely dominant for the Barons so far in the early going. And Tim Elko, I think we've hit on his numbers multiple times throughout the season here, but just to get you up to date on the latest, if you missed it, again, he homered last night. Tim Elko is now hitting .357 on the season. He's got 10 homers, 21 RBIs. He has a .434 on base percentage, and he's slugging .704, which means his OPS is .1138. Yes, an eye-popping .1138 for Tim Elko in 27 games. Not too shabby, if I do say so myself. Hey, Sox fans, learn from the pros this summer at a White Sox summer camp presented by Wintrust. Starting at $165, kids ages 5 to 12 can register for a four-day baseball camp offered at over 35 locations throughout the Chicagoland area. Campers will receive a Sox swag bag with a custom sliding mitt, pack of Topps baseball cards, and more. To learn more, visit whitesox.com/play. I'm Jeff Meller, live from Wright Field, as we are getting set for White Sox and Astros game number 2 of this 3-game set. When we come back, we'll let you hear from another 2005 World Series hero. Aaron Rowan joined Len Casper and Darren Jackson in the booth yesterday. If you missed it, we'll catch you up right here on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network. Still looking for a Mother's Day gift? Join us on Sunday, May 11th, to celebrate all moms with a special pregame parade around the field before the game at 1:10 p.m. Don't miss the chance to gift a heartwarming day at the ballpark and an unforgettable experience on the field. To purchase tickets, visit whitesox.com/Mother's Day. I'm Jeff Meller here on White Sox Weekly. If you missed it yesterday, Aaron Rowan hopped into the booth with Len and DJ. Fun stuff with the 2005 World Series champ.
How are things?
Wonderful, especially after last night. Being able to raise money for the White Sox charities is great.
Enjoyed the conversation you had with Chuck Garfine, Ozzie Guillen, John Garland. When you come back to this ballpark, what's kind of the first thing that pops into your mind?
Oh, man.
Not the first 15, but just one or two little details.
All right, so for a really good one, I forget, it might have been 03. And we broke out, I don't know if DJ, if you remember this or not, we broke out some of the aluminum bats.
Oh, I do
for batting
that.
Practice, yes.
Oh, yeah.
And watching Frank and Maglio hit balls off that off that sign.
Yes.
That is a memorable thing.
Wow. Kenny heard what was going on and came out and said, knock it off. You're going to kill somebody.
Yeah. Major League Baseball came in and said, you can't do that anymore.
Yeah. I do remember. Oh, man, what a memory that is.
I hate that sound, by the way. I love college baseball. But, yeah, there's nothing better than wood hitting the ball. Yeah, the ping is not great.
It was really hard to go from playing professional baseball back to watching college baseball.
Sure.
And hearing that.
We'll get back to the White Sox in a second, but, you know, I just think of how fearless you were in the outfield. And what's interesting to me, and maybe you can explain it, is the only comp I could make for you is a guy you played with in college, Reed Johnson. He played just like you. What was in the water at Cal State Fullerton?
You know what? I think we just both had the same mentality, and it was kind of a football mentality. DJ and I were talking about it last night. Great story. My very first spring training, it was DJ's last year, and we were doing outfield drills, and they were using the machine to hit line drives at us. And I ran in, and I laid out, full layout, in spring training, like drills. I laid out, I caught the ball, got up, threw the ball back in, walked back to get in line for all the other guys, and DJ and John Cangelosi looked at me and was like, "Don't ever show us up again like that." And I was like, "Oh, okay." So it was kind of a learning experience, but that's how I was brought up. You know, that's how we did at Fullerton, and Reed was the same way. He played the game the same way. You know, it's kind of a football mentality, like, hey, catch the ball or bust. That's it.
That's it.
Well, the thing is, when you see a kid come out doing that in his first big league camp and you realize, you know, he's got a long future ahead of him, and getting hurt diving for balls in practice and spring training is not where you want him to spend time on the IL.
Diaz with a deep fly ball, and Robert's going to have to play it off the wall out in left center. Walker around third. He's going to score. Boy, that ball really shot off the bat of Yiner Diaz, and it's 2-1.
That was a good route, though. Louis ran a good route right there.
You know, if anybody knows that and can judge that, it'd be you, because you were an outfield instructor and base running instructor after your career finished. So not only played the game at a high level of expertise in center field, you taught it as well. What do you miss about the game right now?
I miss this. I miss the competition. And you know, as an ex-player, too. You don't miss the off seasons, and you don't miss spring training. But you miss actually playing the game. And right there, even though Louis is playing on the opposite side right there, he turned around. He's not playing too deep. He put his head down. He ran to a spot. The guy hit the ball too hard. That's it.
Yep. You know, one of the things that I'm curious about for you right now, what do you love about today's baseball game? There's got to be something that you do love in the changes of the game today.
Oh, well,
it would have been easy to say, what don't you like?
Right.
Right.
The pitch is low, one and two.
The hard part is, what do you love? There's got to be something in the game now.
I love the cat and mouse game between the hitter and the pitcher and how it's changed. And, you know, back in the day.
You're that guy now. You're that old guy back in the day. You're like me now.
No, but I'm not. No, you're not that guy, and you never were. You remember when we were playing, and like some of the older guys would come in and be like, I can't believe you're doing this, and I can't believe you're doing that, and why can't you just move the ball, this, that, the other? It's like, do you not remember how hard this game is?
Yeah, well.
This game is hard.
That's it.
And what I do love, and what I love to watch, is now that, you know, everything's changed with swing, you know, with the everybody wants to.
Everybody's got the uppercut now, right?
Yeah, and, well, that's what's taught, and that's what's the analytics of it, and launch angle, and all that kind of stuff. What I enjoy watching, though, is that the approach from the pitchers adjusting to the swing changes is what I enjoy watching. Like, hey, yeah, this guy's going to run a fastball up over his hands because he can't get to it.
There you go. Working the top of the strike zone more.
Yes.
Name a player you love watching now. A player. Just one player you love watching.
I love watching Benintendi play.
Okay.
I love watching Andrew play. I love Mookie Betts.
Oh, yeah. Well, you can't go wrong with that. Yes.
You know, I love watching Freddie Freeman, too, because he's old school. And he reminds me of a Joey Votto that doesn't mind getting jammed to get hit.
Yeah, good call.
By the way, once or twice a game, DJ says he's got to try to jam himself here for hit.
You really do.
He talks about
because
all the time.
If you're not getting jammed occasionally, then you're not being a very good hitter. It means you're pulling off everything.
That's great. All right, we'll see you in July for sure.
Absolutely. Thank you
very much for having me. Thank you, Aaron.
Fun conversation last night in the booth with Len and DJ Aaron Rowan joined them, and there'll be plenty more of that this year, I promise you, as we celebrate the 20th anniversary of the 2005 World Series Championship. Hey, Sox fans, start your game day with a pregame patio party. 2 hours of an all-you-can-eat and drink buffet starting at just $63 per person. It's the best value in the ballpark for food, fun, and excitement. For more information, visit whitesox.com/party areas or call 312-674-1000. That does it for White Sox Weekly. Up next, it is your White Sox pregame show on the ESPN 1000 Hard Rock Casino White Sox Network.